Hello, welcome to Beamcast. This is the June 28th edition of the ShonenBeam.com podcast. My name is Jean.
My name is Drew.
My name is Clint.
ShonenBeam at gmail.com is the ShonenBeam inbox. Big news this week, the World Cup still underway. I believe if you listen very closely, you can hear England has conceded yet another goal to Germany. that was a bit of a disappointing match if you were an England supporter, but some interesting results. USA knocked out of the competition in a very exciting game. I believe you guys were kind of, at least you, Drew, were following the U.S. team, weren't you?
Yeah, I was watching it as a fan and with people who were not fans. So that game didn't go too well.
That's a pity. Not a fan of the U.S. team myself, but they were fun to watch, and it's too bad that they're gone, if only from a standpoint of the interest will be less over here now. We have a release date, or at least a release window, for the Nintendo 3DS, the upcoming three-dimensional handheld system from Nintendo. Clint?
Oh, yeah. It's slated for quarter one of 2011.
Which is too far away, but I suppose acceptable.
Yeah, I kind of can't wait on it. Like, the idea of something that it plays in 3D, but you don't need glasses, is something that the TV companies haven't even experimented with yet.
Yeah. There were two other video game notes that I just thought of that I wanted to mention very briefly, one of which is we have some semi-confirmation. No one will actually come out and say this is happening, but semi-confirmation on remakes for both Final Fantasy V and VI for the 3DS. And then also,
yeah, I saw that story.
Super awesome news. This is somewhat related to anime, at least, if not specifically shonen, but Level 5, the designers behind the Professor Layton series, Rogue Galaxy, Dragon Quest VIII, are making a Studio Ghibli RPG based on the upcoming film. So that should be fantastic. I've seen a video. Looks great. But let's jump into actual Shonen news, because we are a Shonen show. And we have quite a bit of Shueisha news to begin with. Shueisha, the publishers of Shonen Jump. And there have been some cancellations over in that fine magazine. Lock On and Kiben Gakuhai Yotsuya Senpai no Kaidan are both canceled from the magazine. We have two new upcoming debutantes to the magazine, though. Omagadoki Dobutsu-sen, Omagadoki Zoo, and SWAT, or... if that's supposed to be an anagram, or an acronym, I mean, pardon me, is SWOT. So two series that we know and did not really love are out of the magazine. Lock On, decidedly mediocre. The art was not ever very good. Got better near the end, but really, you know, we could have seen this coming. And then Yotsuya, kind of the inverse problem, which was the art was actually pretty cool, but the story was just a ripoff somewhat.
Yeah, very much so. For, like, Yotsuya, you see the same basic character types as in Neuro.
Right. Now, Omagadoki Dobutsu-en, the Omagadoki Zoo one, looks at least fairly interesting and different from anything else that they're going to have in the magazine. It's I get
Death Flag vibes from that one, though.
Really?
Yeah.
How so?
I mean, just immediately to me, it doesn't seem like the kind of thing that would be able to fly and jump.
It is decidedly niche and or alternative, so I could at least see your point there. But it's, you know, on the other hand, it's different from anything else that's being offered, so if it does go over well with an audience, they'll have more incentive to keep it.
I guess, like, I just, obviously it could be interesting. I can't judge it without having actually read any of it, but
right,
it does not immediately strike, it strikes me as something that could be interesting and probably would get a longer run than it's going to get in Jump if it ran somewhere else.
Yeah. And then SWAT, which is a lot more mainstream. It's about a nerdy boy who, you know, has ambitions. He studies too much. Apparently SWAT is the name given to people who study too much, and he has ambitions of becoming, I believe, an astronaut working for NASA, graduating from Tokyo University. But then he goes to this school, which he thinks is renowned for its academics, and it has since fallen out of favor and is overrun by delinquents, so it's kind of the wacky misadventures thereafter, with art that very, very much looks like Bakuman. He pretty much just looks like Mashiro from all accounts thus far, so we'll see how those turn out. But I've read both of the one-shots. They're each of them probably about a solid 7 out of 10 each, but I'm not certain that they will translate too well into series. We'll have to see. But the immediate news is that Lock On and Yotsuya are both canceled, effective very soon. Other news from Shueisha: Toriko and Beelzebub are both receiving animation adaptations of some type for the upcoming Jump anime tour. Now, this is almost certainly not a full series for either. However, we did see Toriko receive an animation for the Jump Festa last year, So it's likely going to be a similar sort of thing for both of these, just an animated short, but any kind of an adaptation is good news for the future.
Certainly, the fact that Toriko's getting another Jump OVA means that an anime series almost feels like it's imminent as soon as there are enough chapters to back up, say, 26 or 52 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to see Beelzebub get an adaptation sometime in the future, a full series. That would be awesome.
100% agree with you. Just don't think that that's the time right now, because we don't have, we're what, 66 chapters in? That's not nearly enough for there not
way
to be filler.
Early. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just hopefully they get Norio Wakamoto to voice Baby Beel.
Oh, that would be incredible.
Makes so much of my day.
With all of his incoherent mumbling, that would be fantastic. All the baby talk from Wakamoto. I love it. In other news from other magazines, the iconic generational baseball series Major is finally ending. The final chapter, which will be chapter 747, will be released in issue 32 of Sunday, this upcoming July 7th. Kind of surprising to see. I mean, you know, granted, we don't really get any kind of scanlations of Major, so for all we know, it could have been obvious that the end was coming. But still, I mean, any story that's been going for, what, 15 or 16 years now, for it to end is a major deal. No pun intended.
Yeah, this is obviously very major news, pun intended. And it's interesting that they're letting it end at the same time they just started releasing the manga for the app, the Shonen Sunday app.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So it's just a coincidence, but it feels like they would want to keep it running for a little bit longer to keep interest in it going. Because now they've got, out of the four initial series that Shonen Sunday launched on its app, Detective Conan is the only current one. All the rest are going to be over, and that might make it harder for them to succeed in digital manga.
I would imagine that for those purposes, though, they were just looking at what's popular, not necessarily what is still going.
True, but there's a certain appeal to being able to catch up to a current series.
Oh, I completely agree. Believe me, I'm fan number one behind the concept of them offering current manga translated, but that was the special feature and no longer in this episode of the show. Toaru Kagaku no Railgun is receiving an OVA this upcoming October 29th, which that OVA is a spin-off of the spin-off of Toaru Majutsu no Index, which, I mean, personal feelings from each of us for a moment here. I personally preferred Index. I felt that was, you know, science versus magic, an interesting idea, and then they kind of totally deviated from it into just looking at girls in Railgun.
Yeah.
I don't know how you guys felt about that.
I couldn't support Railgun any less. I thought Index was a really interesting world, and I would have loved to see them do more with, like, the science versus magic stuff and the fights. And then what they did with Railgun was just essentially make a fan service series of, like, girls. And I really just didn't like it.
I haven't seen Index, but it's on my list, so I can't really give an evaluation on it yet.
Fair enough. Some sad, unfortunate news here. The voice actor Takeshi Aono has been hospitalized after a stroke. If you are at all an anime fan, chances are you have heard him. He played the role of Kami-sama in Dragon Ball Kai. He's a Mihawk in One Piece. The Piccolo, older Piccolo in the original Dragon Ball. Shiro Sanada in Space Battleship Yamato. So quite a few really notable voices. And certain of his roles, which are still current, like, for example, Kami-sama and Mihawk, are being recast, so it is serious enough that he is not able to perform his work duties. So that's very unfortunate news, because at least knowing him from a couple of those roles, most notably Mihawk, a good voice actor, so it's sad news. And moving right along then, we have artists from Shueisha who are drawing classic novel covers, a bit of an odd but interesting story. The artist behind Letter B, or Tegami Bachi, Hiroyuki Asada, has illustrated a new cover for Night on the Galactic Railroad. Katsura Hoshino, best known for De Grey Man, has drawn a cover for The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. Kawashita Mizuki, best known for Ichigo 100%, also did Hatsukoi Limited and a few other one-shots, has illustrated a new cover for Takekurabe. It's an upcoming novella, so just interesting to see some crossover there. Artists got to make their money somehow, I suppose.
I guess it fits in with what both of these artists do, insofar as what I've seen of D. Gray Man and Letter B fits in with the fashion sense of these novels.
True. This is not shown in news, but it is interesting enough to point out. The director of the Hollywood film The Book of Eli, Albert Hughes, has revealed that Warner Brothers, who have been pitching Akira, the live-action adaptation of Akira, apparently they want a PG-13 ranking for it. So evidently Albert Hughes was approached by Warner Brothers to do it, but he was told explicitly it would have to be PG-13. A bit of an interesting choice there.
That would pretty much ruin it. Great job, Warner Brothers. That would kill the movie.
You know they're going to go for a PG-13 rating whenever they adapt a famous comic.
It's kind of strange. I admire at least, you know, I know nothing about Albert Hughes. I haven't even seen Book of Eli, so I'm not commenting on him and his works or anything. But the statement that he released was actually interesting in that he was, I'm going to paraphrase hugely here, but he was treating it like a challenge, you know. He kind of related the situation to what director Christopher Nolan did with Batman and The Dark Knight and all that, making those, you know, they're gritty, but they're still PG-13, the films. So seeing what he can explore, what kind of tones and themes he can explore within that rating system. So admire the concept there, but still, for Warner Brothers to just flat out say, you know, this hugely popular, hugely successful, you know, Akira is a notable name in the world of anime, even beyond the world of anime, to mandate that it has a PG-13 rating. A bit disappointing from Warner Brothers, if nothing else.
I'd say I've kind of been expecting it ever since they, like, there were hints of a live action Akira movie.
Mm-hmm.
R-rated movies, like, if they're not The Watchmen, like, don't even remotely sell, and Watchmen didn't even do that great in the box office. So, like, you just, if you want to get serious sales for an action type movie, then you got to go PG-13.
That's too bad, but I guess he'll do his best, and we'll find out if he is able to turn it into anything interesting when we all go see it. He said. let's look at the Oricon rankings for the week of June 14th through the 20th. Topping the list this week is a holdover from the previous week, which is Kimi ni Todoke Volume 11. With this week's sales of just under 250,000, bringing the total to 722,000. Looking down the list, Kuroshitsuji 9, Skip Beat 25, Hajime no Ippo 92, and One Piece 58 round out the top five. Mostly, this is a very slow week. It seems to be a lot of holdovers from previous weeks. I mean, you have a few debutantes onto the list. Aria no Kishi 21, The World God Only Knows number 9, Yankee Kunto Megane-chan is also on the list at position 14 with volume 18. But for the most part, it's holdovers from previous weeks.
Yeah, I see that One Piece 58 just broke 2 million copies, so.
Always good news.
That's another volume they can chalk down to it.
Yeah.
Seems to do that a lot.
Yeah, it's good that you pointed it out, because I was so completely unsurprised by that. I didn't even say anything about it. That's like, oh, okay, well, another 2 million copies sold of One Piece. Ho-hum.
It is kind of inevitable at this point.
Yeah.
Like, a series as popular as it.
It is notable in that if that were any other series, it would be humongous news. But
yeah, the fact that we just kind of, oh, by the way, you know, it cracked 2 million copies, yeah. It's popular. This just in. Let's take a look at the release dates for this upcoming week in anime first. We have the Complete Series Collection DVD Set 1 for Fist of the North Star. This encompasses episodes 1 through 36 of the anime series at a manufacturer's suggested retail price of $59.99. So for $60, is 36 episodes worth it?
That's an interesting question. I mean, it is Fist of the North Star, but it's also the anime of Fist of the North Star.
Yeah. I mean, to be perfectly honest, Fist of the North Star, important, very, very important in the history of Shonen. Hugely important, but not terribly excellent, really, I would have to go out and say. It's good, but I mean, you have to go into it knowing what you want, and what you want has to just be mindless violence.
It's sort of like trying to catch up on Dragon Ball via Dragon Ball Z.
Right. So, I mean, good to know that this collection is out there and is being released. If nothing else, it deserved release, but I'm not sure I would pay $60. Even for 36 episodes is a lot of episodes, granted, but I'm not sure I would pay that much. Gintama Collection 2 on DVD, which is episodes 14 to 26, retailing at $50. $50, 14 to 26 for Gintama. Gintama is funny. It's very funny. And the anime, even when it has filler, Gintama, as much as any other series, lends itself to filler because, even the actual canon story is so off the wall that you can barely ever tell the difference. But again, $50 is still quite a bit of money for that many episodes.
Yeah, if it was 1 through 26, I could get behind that, but 14 through 26 being Collection 2, I'd wait for the price to come down or something.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of surprised because they licensed Gintama. The way that they're releasing it split up like this at such a high price point, I wonder if they really have any idea what they're doing. Because Gintama, by nature, is such a Japanese type of show. All of the jokes are inherently Japanese puns. For them to try to market it to the general anime audience, which is what you have to be expecting when you're pricing it that high.
It's quite popular among English speakers, to my knowledge.
It is. It's just not casual fans, as far as I'm aware. It's more people who can understand and appreciate, you know, Japanese puns, or can take the time to learn or read the subtitles explaining a joke.
And those tend to be the people who will buy the higher-priced box sets, though.
Fair enough.
If you have a more limited audience, you raise the price. That's basically why American manga is priced so high.
Initial D, Stage 4, Part 2, DVD, episodes 13 through 24, retailing at $60. That is even more price per episode.
Yeah, especially for Purple Shadow.
Yeah, that's...
I've seen the part of the anime this covers. It's not particularly exceptional. It's the first part of Stage 4 you really have to have, and that's probably a lot cheaper by now.
Naruto Season 3, this is DVD 1, so Part 1 of Season 3, episodes 107 through 135, retailing at $50. Now, we've taken a look and seen what episodes these cover. This is actually the end of the series as far as people who hate filler are concerned. This takes you through the chase after Sasuke to the ultimate fight, and it ends on the very last episode of non-filler. So if we could ever recommend Naruto DVDs, this would be it.
Anything after this, no.
Right.
Yeah, it's just a bunch of random filler arcs that end the exact same way. This is, in general, just a good set of episodes for the series, so if you want to purchase it, go ahead and do it. I can recommend it.
I say $50. Having looked around while assembling this list, I've seen it's already down to $30 on some websites. I'm not going to promote them, but you know, you can probably find it for a lot cheaper by now, even. And over in manga, we only have one title to talk about because Drew loves it so much, apparently. Sergeant Frog, Volume 19, retailing for $11. Just go ahead and rant and rave about how amazing Sergeant Frog is.
Standard price. I haven't read more recent Sergeant Frog, but it's a very solid gag manga for the most part. It's generally age-appropriate stuff, but it's fun enough, just random satire about alien invaders, that I could recommend this series for somebody to just pick up and start reading. It's very episodic.
Well, that brings us now to our current and classic review segment, where this week we're going to take a look at current Hajime no Ippo, which is an iconic boxing series ever since the 80s now by George Morikawa. Follows the story of up-and-coming boxer Makunouchi Ippo, as he learns about this here sport of boxing and rises his way up the rankings and has good old boxing fights. So general pros about this series, I think first and foremost it has to be said that there's only two really hugely notable boxing series, this and Ashita no Joe. And Ashita no Joe isn't really known for its technical boxing. Boxing features in the series, but it kind of features in the same way that soccer features in the early parts of Captain Tsubasa, very fantasy style. Hajime no Ippo, without a shadow of a doubt, is the best actual boxing series in terms of technical accuracy.
The guy who does Hajime no Ippo actually like coaches a Japanese boxer who's fairly ranked high, so you know at least you're getting a lot of professional experience and knowledge, and the fights are, again, very well illustrated, so you can always see what's happening. And it is, with a few exceptions, extremely realistic.
Right.
Yeah, the technical aspects of the fight I find really interesting, and like it does its best to give you a realistic view of like actual strategies that boxers would use. I think it's very well done in that aspect and really interesting.
We mentioned the characterization in the lead up to this show. Characterization throughout this series, excellent overall. Drew, I believe you had some specific points to make.
The characterization in Ippo is very rarely matched in series that I've read. The thing is that every single opponent that Ippo and even his friends at the gym that he fights are extremely well developed to the point that even when they're beating on Ippo, who is our lovable protagonist, you can really feel for them, and it makes sure that beyond even the technical aspects of boxing, which are extremely good, the characters in the fights almost never get dull.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And then also just the wide cast of characters. Again, with a few exceptions, and those are notable exceptions, but with those few exceptions, the characters overall, every one of them has some kind of interesting facet about them, interesting enough to differentiate them from other characters and to keep the reader engaged. Because, you know, a lot can be said about sports series, that they are formulaic within themselves and that they repeat the same concept over and over again and just twist it a little bit every time. Here you have characters different enough from each other that it never feels stale. If you like a good underdog story, this is a great, great manga for you to pick up.
Yeah, Ippo starts out as basically like, he's not a weakling, he has a physical build, but he's basically getting pushed around by everyone and he has no confidence. And you really see him develop as a character and just like grow enormously.
The comedy aspects of this series are strangely brilliant. You wouldn't expect it from a boxing series, but anytime comedy is thrown into the mix, it's pulled off masterfully well.
It's essentially very locker room, the style of comedy it does. It sets up the five main characters, Ippo's gym mates, and just develops all sorts of strange situations that they get involved in. There's a lot of comparing, like, sizes, if you know what I mean.
In a locker room context, yeah. And then, obviously, down to something that is overwhelmingly important, the fights themselves. Just some of these fights, maybe not everyone equally with one another, but some of the best fights in this series are some of the best manga I've read ever. Some of these fights are true, epic, truly memorable fights.
Yeah, in particular, you can remember, if you've read Ippo, you will remember particular fights that stand in your head years and years after you've last read of them.
Yes.
They're incredibly memorable, and it climaxes that are developed like you wouldn't believe.
I'm trying not to spoil, because this is our non-spoiler segment, but yes, I have at least one example readily available, and I'm sure any potential readers would have the same after reading it. Unfortunately, it is not all perfect. Looking at cons, certain fights and or fighters do tend to let the series down. One notable fighter in particular, again, we're not going to spoil who that is, but there is one fight that is just practically unreadable that really took away a lot from the series. So while there are some fantastic fights, there are some fights that really do tend to kind of bring down the entire experience, let me say.
In my view, it's just there is a particular fight, and certainly the fights will vary in quality, but there will certainly be a fight that when you get to it, you will know that this is the fight that we're talking about that was very subpar quality and sort of disrupted the whole series.
If you're a fan of plot development across the board, meaning covering every single item that's ever been introduced, you may be let down by certain elements here, because there are some teased story elements that really have yet to develop pretty much at all, and we're 900 chapters into this series.
They've had plenty of time to develop and just never did.
Yeah, certainly for 900 chapters, it's a long time to watch things not happen, which they have not happened.
Right. And then obviously, we mentioned 900 chapters in. It is rather daunting and intimidating in length to begin. Now that said, this is a con with an asterisk, because you shouldn't look at it as just a challenge to read. Yes, it is long, but you're never going to want to stop in the middle of a fight. So it's great to read in bursts, if nothing else. But ultimately, 900 chapters is 900 chapters. So, you know, we can totally respect you for feeling like that's just way too much to get into. So if you're looking for a short, quick read, this may not be the series for you. Well, looking at the adaptations then, it has received two different adaptations. There is the original anime series, simply entitled Hajime no Ippo, which is good by all accounts. Do we agree?
Yeah.
Solid adaptation, good animation, good music, etc. There is also the more recent New Challenger, Hajime no Ippo New Challenger adaptation, which is, again, a good adaptation. It has better animation than the original series, but worse music, so it's a little bit of a trade-off there.
I would like to note that New Challenger does contain one of the most memorable fights of Ippo that we were mentioning earlier.
Yes, the one I was thinking of.
New Challenger is basically a continuation of the main series. Normally you wouldn't even bring up the fact that the music isn't as good. It's just that the music in the first season was so fantastic that the vocal direction in New Challenger feels not as good to the extent that you can actually mention it. The animation in New Challenger is certainly fantastic.
That brings us to our ratings then. Clint, do you have a rating for the series?
I do. I'm going to give Hajime no Ippo 9 out of 10. It's an exceedingly well-done series. Recent developments may put a mark on the series for some people, but I mean, time stands that it's just one of the greatest boxing manga of all time, if not the greatest, with only Ashino Joe competing, and that's quite a high-tiered competitor.
Yeah, for me, Ippo is a solid 10 out of 10. There have been some, I guess, less inspiring events recently, but overall, it's been 20 years of solid quality for a boxing manga and characterization that I really have not seen the equal of in maybe one or two other series.
And for me, I give it an 8 out of 10. Solidly enjoyable. In fact, more than solid. Immensely enjoyable in certain parts. Some of the other parts do tend to drag a little bit. And again, it is rather a long read. So there are, you know, some points deducted for sheer length and some lack of certain storyline development over that length. But overall, I'm still extremely strong recommendation from me and obviously from the other two. We'll move now to our classic this week, which is Love Hina, which is a rather awkward transition from boxing to romantic comedy. The synopsis of this is hopefully well known to you by now. You know, Love Hina is ecchi fan service. It's a boy who ends up in living in a female dorm, and all sorts of wacky hijinks ensue. And there is a somewhat serious romantic plot overarching this entire story, but ultimately it is just a lot of fan service, ecchi, etc. So pros, if that's what you like in a series, if you enjoy fan service, if you enjoy pratfalling onto naked women, etc., you will love Hina because that's really what brought all of this surge of these types of shows about.
Yeah, I mean, Love Hina is kind of like, it's the keystone, if you will. It's the original, like, it's not the first, and it may not be the best example of, like, a harem comedy, but it is certainly like what every single one from now on will be compared to. It popularized it in a way that can't even be called popularizing. It kind of invented the genre.
Very specifically in America, we kind of forget about it now, but it was absolutely huge as part of this new wave of anime fandom in America some years ago. The art is maybe not the best art you've ever seen, but it is quite good, especially in context. You know, Akamatsu, who also, for Maho Sensei Negima fans, same artist, Akamatsu does a very good job of conveying everything that's going on, and, you know, he can draw a pretty lady or two.
Yeah.
The actual plot itself, whenever you actually get to that plot, is quite interesting. You know, I'm not going to get too much into it, but there's basically some, you know, the red string of fate, as they like to say, connecting a couple characters, which we won't mention, but whenever they do actually get into that segment of the plot, it is pretty well done.
Yeah, and without spoiling at all, the plot does have an ending to it that, unlike a lot of harem comedy anime, is unending, so you can actually look forward to an ending.
Now, looking at the cons, given that this is the ultimate harem comedy, if you don't like harem comedy, you will not like Love Hina, because that is everything it brings to the table, nothing more, nothing less.
Yeah, I mean, saying that you don't like harem comedy is also, it's like a synonym of saying, I don't like Love Hina.
Right.
And that may have been what occurred for me. I read a little bit of Love Hina getting into this podcast, about 40 chapters into it. I enjoy the actual plot element of the story. It's fairly well done, but the actual chapter-to-chapter romantic comedy is the type of stuff that if you don't like standard romantic comedy, you probably won't like.
And then regarding that main storyline that we hinted at, if you like it, you may very well end up disappointed, because it is introduced and it is brought up every once in a while, but ultimately it is kind of shelved for the bulk of the series. Most of the series is just little episodic comedy bits that don't really focus on this main storyline at all. The anime, there is an anime adaptation and an anime OVA adaptation. The anime itself is a solid adaptation. It's not excellent, but you know, it was especially good at the time. I will say, having seen a couple episodes of it again recently, it doesn't seem to stand the test of time, but it's a decent enough adaptation of the series. You may enjoy it fairly well. Love Hina Again, however, which is the name given to the OVAs, was rather poor. They overhauled quite a bit, and it's an anime original ending. So it's yeah, a filler ending with much very specifically what upset me was the music. Again, as with Hajime no Ippo, we wouldn't ordinarily talk about the music too much, but this was so notably worse that it bears mentioning.
Anytime you see an anime original ending, it should kind of set off red flags for you, and especially when Love Hina had a good ending to start with, and then they changed it, not good.
Well, let's give our ratings then, Clint.
Love Hina, for me, is a 7. I thoroughly enjoyed it when I first read it. I mean, it is very important as being, like, the most important harem comedy. But it's not, like, spectacular. It's not over-the-top good. It's not going to blow you out of the water with, like, plot developments or anything like that.
True.
I've read about a third of Love Hina. My rating for it is a 5 out of 10. I enjoyed the plot when it was going, but I didn't enjoy as much the standard chapter-to-chapter developments. And so that's just my rating after having read a third of it and probably not going to be going back to it.
I have completed it many years ago. My rating for it is a 6 out of 10. Enjoyable, and I believe that frame of reference as a reader is very important here. I don't believe that I would enjoy it as much if I were new to it now. Especially, I mean that in two different ways. I mean both as being an older person now, not old, but, you know, be a little bit more mature, and also having seen and read other series, it does change your reference point. So if you are fairly new to the harem genre, I think you will enjoy this more. If you're sick of them, you're certainly going to enjoy it less. For me, enjoyable, but nothing groundbreaking, 6 out of 10. Now from the spoiler-free zone to the spoiler-intensive zone, we're moving on to the Great Shonen tier list. Just to recap briefly, last week we introduced the concept of the broken tier. So we have Aizen and Hao from Bleach and Shaman King respectively up there. But our actual top five for the main tier stands as number 1, Goku, number 2, Jotaro, number 3, Negi, number 4, Hyobu, and number 5, Ichigo. And so first up for introduction this week is Hatake Kakashi from Naruto, the copy ninja. How do we feel? Where are we looking at on this overall tier list to begin with, guys?
Please. I think we start off probably around Naruto and then go down from there.
Okay.
I think he's going to be below Naruto, obviously.
Yes,
how
clearly
much lower
he
is a question.
Let's kind of sum up his abilities right now. I mean, he has at his disposal all the different jutsus that he's ever seen used against him. That's kind of the entire basis behind the copy ninja nickname. But he does also have the Mangekyo now, on top of just also being a ninja.
Yeah, and I mean, it's limited use. He can't exactly quick fire it off. It does kind of put him in a hospital, but right. He has it in his inventory.
Exactly.
If they can be cut in half via splitting space, they can be cut in half. And that'll win him a lot of fights.
All right. So let's take a look then. Let's jump down a few spots here and take a look at how he would fare against psychics. How do you think that would play out, Drew?
I feel like he wouldn't be able to beat Ageha, definitely, just because Melksu's door could split him in half easily as fast as he could prepare the Mangekyo for that, and probably block most of his techniques as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think just going up against a psychokinetic, he might fare a bit better. I think he may be able to do something to get past just raw psychokinetic defenses.
Okay.
And he's fast enough to maybe be able to dodge an instant kill.
Okay, now, Clint, looking one spot below that, Maka and Soul from Soul Eater, do you have any objection to him beating them?
No, they don't really have any defense for being sucked into an alternate dimension by being looked at.
Okay. You mean that hasn't come up in Soul Eater?
No, surprisingly.
That's strange. Okay, next up is Kuchiki Byakuya from Bleach, Rukia's older brother. His ability, I mean, he obviously, aside from just being a captain and having all the Kido and being a good swordsman, his Bankai, which is probably the most notable definition of him, is the ability to create / split up his sword into, you know, countless smaller swords, and just kind of, it's an all-encompassing stab attack, omnidirectional, really.
It's kind of like a crocodile-style attack. Only
it cuts
more effectively.
Maybe more Gaara than crocodile, but instead of being sand, it's just blades.
It's a great way to look at something. So where are we looking here?
Same area to start out with, I would think.
Because again, he is going to be blindingly fast, as is everyone in Bleach.
Are still applicable in that series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so how do we feel about... Go ahead, Clint.
He's really fast, so I would immediately look at above Vash. I mean, Drew knows the psychics, and we all know Vash. Do you guys have any real objection to him being put above them? Just because, based on pure speed and power that is inherent to almost everyone in the Bleach universe...
As far as the psychic I know better, which is Yoshina from Siren, I would say that Byakuya could take him, just on the concept that I don't think that Melchizedek really has an answer for... it. Maybe it could take out some of the blades, but I don't think that he'd be able to create enough of a Melchizedek, large enough, all-encompassing enough, to be able to stop all of them.
And I think psychic, if it becomes a stall war, even if he could defend against all of them, Melchizedek runs out significantly faster than Kudo does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if they both lost their primary form of attack, take out Melchizedek and take out the Bankai, then hands down, Kuchiki wins that. So, yeah, I would agree with that. Then looking at Vash, Angel Arm, agile for a plant human, but still, you know, nowhere near Bleach speed. I say that the battle is, you know, quite frankly, it might even be to Kuchiki's advantage not to go Bankai, to just, you know, do the Shunpo up to him and slash him in half.
Yeah, might be what he did, actually, in the fight. What he would do is just cut Vash in half right off the get-go.
I think if he can just, like, walk up behind them, get an instant slash for the kill, that's what it'll do.
Okay, so then that leaves us looking at Kuchiki versus Yusuke. Now, Yusuke... Again, we've talked over the few weeks. Incredible beam spammer, to put it one way. Has the demon energy. So resilient, tough, and certainly can dish out a lot of damage, but can he hit Kuchiki?
I mean, Byakuya's fast. Take away his speed, he still has the Bankai to block. It is kind of an absolute defense and attack at the same time.
Drew?
I don't know if the Bankai is an absolute defense, but I just think as far as speed goes, beam spam isn't that effective, and Yusuke isn't blindingly fast.
Right.
Speed counts still for a lot in this battle, just because of how fast Bleach characters are.
I would tend to agree with that, then. So looking at Naruto, then. Recent Naruto with the Gargantuan Rasengan Barrage and all that. This is going to be the first true test, I would think.
Yeah, it would be an interesting fight. I'm once again wondering, like, which characters on this list can really stand up to having a character, you know, for all intents and purposes, they're moving, but it's a teleport. They're being teleported behind.
That's a good point.
That's how each character's move, I mean.
Right.
I feel like Naruto's real defense against that would be the Shadow Clones, and then you have Bankai, which is just all the swords at once. And the Shadow Clones get hit once and they're done. So I'm not sure if Naruto has an honest answer to that.
Yeah,
right.
At the worst, that's a matchup issue for him, but even then, I might not even just say that that's a matchup thing. I think that Naruto would lose that, so let's continue to go higher. Sasuke, is this
now,
fairly
the,
similar, or...?
The eye hacks are interesting, because we've seen something to that effect in Bleach, a power that is transmitted through being looked at in Bleach, and Byakuya could block it with the blades.
True. Could Sasuke hit him with any other attack?
He has a good defense against being attacked from behind with being surrounded by the skeletal soldier, so I'm saying this is a fight that Byakuya couldn't win by just teleporting behind him and cutting him in half. And also the arrows are incredibly destructive, could perhaps penetrate through like a wall of like the sword bits.
Yeah, I think if speed doesn't give him the advantage, then eventually it does run out as characters lose their stamina in Bleach.
Yeah,
I think the Skull Summon is probably long-lasting enough to outlast that.
Yeah,
I'm kind of seeing a matchup issue there for him because of that skeletal soldier. He doesn't have a good way to attack Sasuke, and Sasuke would eventually catch him with the eyes or the gigantic arrow or...
Okay. So that's where he's going to go, then. He will split up the Sasuke-Naruto pair. Sorry, fangirls.
Aw. No, that just makes it a threesome. I bet they're even happier.
Fantastic. All right, now we're going to look at Roronoa Zoro from One Piece, the swordsman. He uses three swords. That's more than two. So we're looking broken tier now. So we're going to look. Let's start in human because ultimately he is a human.
Start with swordsman.
Start with swordsman. How does this play out? Zoro versus Kenshin.
I kind of want to give the speed advantage to Kenshin, but the cutting power would definitely go to Zoro.
Decidedly.
He can cut metal. Certainly that. He fought a guy made of blades, so like I'm just questioning if he couldn't just cut Kenshin's sword down.
Yeah, I'm wondering if Kenshin hits him before hits him without connecting his blade.
The vacuum wave sort of the Amakakiru Ryu no Higamaki, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, well, like I'm wondering if he cuts Zoro before Zoro is able to block it with a sword.
Okay.
Thus cutting Kenshin's sword in half.
That's tough to say.
I don't think Kenshin has like one shot priority in this battle, and I think if he doesn't, then Zoro just gets his sword. So I give this one to Zoro pretty handily.
I would agree with that. Are you okay with that, Clint?
Yeah, I would pretty much agree.
Okay, now one above that, above our little swordsman grouping here is Ganta.
I'm the only one familiar. A brief rundown of powers once again is that he basically fires bullets, supersonic bullets, made up of his own blood, which have been shown to pierce through large steel doors, concrete walls, completely wreck an arena. I mean, not weak, much stronger than a gun by any means.
Right. That seems like it's going to beat Zoro. Let's take a look at one notch above. Edward Elric. Does Ed just soundly beat Zoro?
He has a lot more attack options. Yeah.
He probably can't defend against Zoro, but I don't think he ultimately has to, because he can just attack from pretty much any angle.
He can alter the ground, make the ground under Zoro collapse, or push himself up to the sky. He has a multitude of options. So, below Ganta, then?
Yeah, that's where I'm seeing.
Okay. Fine with that. Inuyasha from... what series? Inuyasha.
Oh, yeah, Inuyasha from Inuyasha.
Oh, right. I thought it was Inuyasha from Cowboy Bebop. My bad. So, swordsman, but not at all the same kind of swordsman. Let's put him with a more similar kind of swordsman, Yo.
Yo is sort of a spirit-based fighter. He has a sword that's spiritually powered and super long, but he's not terribly fast, and Inuyasha is.
Right.
Windscar is a good ranged attack.
Yo right. doesn't have those.
And the backslash, could Yo even hit Inuyasha?
I don't think... The backslash probably wouldn't be an issue. Like, the backslash reflects techniques. I'm not sure if it would reflect another sword.
Okay.
So I don't think that would be an issue, but I think Yo's still going to lose the fight.
Okay. What about Kaguro?
Kaguro from Kakashi. He, again, has swords and is somewhat fast. I don't know if he has he has particular resilience on the level of Inuyasha. I think they're two kind of similar fighters, except he uses one-handed swords and Inuyasha uses two-handed swords. So I'd say just based more on resilience than anything else, Kaguro hasn't been shown to be particularly resilient so much as just an I go fast you kind of character. So
right. Okay. Well, let's jump up a few here so it's not just me talking about Tsuna. Let's look at Ueki. How is that? That's an interesting one. How would that play out exactly?
That's gonna take a minute. I think. Well, first of all, Ueki can fly. Inuyasha effectively counter? Well, I guess he has the wind scar.
He has the wind scar, so he can attack from range.
He can also jump very high.
True. So I don't think that the flying would really be too much of a help. Boy, that's actually a lot tougher one than I expected.
Mm-hmm.
That's just
I guess Ueki, does he have an answer? I guess he has extremely fast speed via the roller skates that he has. And he again has attacking options to the tune of maybe some of his attacks would get deflected, but some of them are just raw physical attacks that wouldn't be deflected by Inuyasha. So I feel like he could get hits in, but in the willpower kind of series he's in, like, they rarely knock people out. So
that's really well. Let's
may actually let's get, that may be Inuyasha, but let's look a little
let's get
lower.
Context.
That.
Let's get some context around Ueki then. Let's go above one first. Crocodile.
I don't feel that that Inuyasha is capable of winning this. I don't think he has a particular answer to sand. He can't really eradicate it all. I mean, I guess Inuyasha is known to get bloodied up.
Mm-hmm.
Is he a smart character by any means to think of trying that to beat Crocodile? No. Inuyasha has never been noted for his intelligence.
Yeah,
he'll just totally charge straight in, try to cut sand in half, and predictably fail.
Right. So then let's look one below Eki, Tommyrod. This is a bit trickier. More straightforward. Oh, really? Do you think so?
Oh, so, I don't know.
I think Tommyrod's method of attack is so... he can shoot bugs. He can summon a giant bug. Inuyasha could kill all of them, right?
Yeah, I mean, Inuyasha's specialty was taking down all those bees that couldn't hurt Moroku in the series.
Right.
Oh, that's going to be a matchup nightmare for Moroku whenever we tier him.
That is really interesting.
Someone finally has poison bees.
Okay, so I would be inclined to say that Inuyasha takes that one.
So, yeah.
So where does he go, above or below Ueki?
Above Ueki? I would say above, yeah. As long as he can deal with Flight and the Mao Bullet, there's nothing Ueki has that's that good.
Well, can he deal with the 10th bullet, though?
That's where the backslash wave comes in, doesn't it? Deflecting your opponent's ultimate technique.
Yeah, I'm
willing to give it. It's a really... I can't believe that's such a bizarre matchup, Ueki versus Inuyasha, but it goes to Inuyasha, and that's where he's going to end up, between Crocodile and Ueki. Moving on, then, we're looking at Gray Fullbuster from Fairy Tail with Ice Make. He can make ice, even though he got the words backwards. So, just the ability to... It's magic... You know, canon, it's magic, actual magic, and it's ice. So we're looking fairly high to begin with.
And realistically, if you freeze people, not a lot of them are going to be able to get back up. He's obviously below Natsu canonically.
Yes.
Yeah. Nagi has a notable
raw willpower factor.
Negi has a notable weakness to being frozen, so.
Right, but... I don't think that's going to play into this too much.
Yeah, I think... Well, the obvious win for him is Suna, who attacks using fire on his hands.
Right, just freeze the hand. Also, there are so many other reasons why Suna would lose that, so that's not really close. Let's see. Kazuma versus a shirtless guy who makes ice. Punching.
Kazuma versus shirtless guy.
That wasn't so much the highlight of my statement, but okay.
But far as like being frozen in ice, actually in the Scryde mangas, Kazuma's canonically frozen in ice for a very long period of time, so he doesn't really have an answer to be frozen.
Okay.
If Kazuma fights Gray, he's basically frozen for 4.5 billion years and then wakes up and revives all of humanity.
Cool.
Scryde manga spoilers.
We did say this is a spoiler. Now, Tommyrod, that's interesting because we know that he's not going to be frozen.
Yeah, he sort of survives all of ice hell easily. So.
Yeah, without any clothing or anything. And obviously his bugs do.
And obviously, like, even in the same universe, like, there's shivering to get rid of cold.
Right.
So, and he can use that. He just thinks it's inelegant, so he doesn't normally.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's more of an easy fight for Tommyrod because he's got a ton of bugs with all sorts of uses to them.
Right.
And he's really physically strong, and ice won't bother him as much.
Is that then a matchup issue? Because I'm looking up two places at Crocodile, and Crocodile would have trouble against ice.
He would.
Would he though?
Like, because I think
that's never been very clearly defined, Logia versus Logia, exactly how that would play out.
Ice is kind of water in its core state, and water was Crocodile's sort of Achilles heel, which never was fully explained, but I guess it muddies him up, and I think ice would ultimately be the same way, especially if they're fighting at a room temperature environment. Ice quickly becomes water.
So then those both would be matchup issues, so let's look in between them. Inuyasha we just ranked. How do you think that would play out?
This ice is being generated basically on an instantaneous scale, right?
Pretty much. He just forms it from his hands and... Yeah.
He ice makes.
I don't know. I kind of think that Inuyasha would be able to deal with it. It's kind of difficult to say why. I just think that he'd be able to just continue breaking and cutting it. I think he would just charge at it like a stereotypical shonen hero, just head on.
I think, like, the issue for Inuyasha kind of breaks it because he has fire rat clothing, actually. It doesn't get discussed a whole lot, but it protects against especially cold and ailments of that sort.
So that's another matchup.
Yeah.
Wow.
Another matchup issue for him.
So then Ueki is going to be the decider somehow. Can Ueki fight a guy who makes ice? He could shatter the ice, but he couldn't continue to shatter the ice enough to stop being frozen, could he?
Yeah, he doesn't really have an answer to being frozen. That's it. That would be gray.
So,
right
so,
below Asha.
Wow, this is so bizarre. So, Gray should be below Tommy Rod, but above Crocodile.
I think that's just the way the matchup works out.
Yeah, so that makes sense. Ueki's the only one in there that isn't exactly a matchup issue. It's more just general strength, so I'm going to put Gray right above him. Let's move on now to Takamura Mamoru from Hajime no Ippo.
Are there any bears on our tier list?
He goes above bears. Toriko Ken looks like a bear.
Looking towards the lower end of the tier list, I'm thinking.
Yes, well, he's obviously above Ippo. Now, we had reasoning, legitimate reasoning, for putting Onizuka above Ippo. But that said, Takamura, not exactly the type to mess about like Ippo might.
I
feel like Takamura has more just ridiculous fighting experience than even Onizuka does.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I'm willing to
give
that one.
Takamura takes that one.
Amano.
I think the rationale for this is he still has a gun.
Yeah.
I mean, he is a realistic character with a gun, and he can shoot it.
Well, that takes care of that. Although, is he a bear?
If he's a bear, he's a cub.
Okay. I just had to check, because this is very important canonically here. From history's strongest disciple Kenichi, Akisame Koetsuji, one of the masters.
Yeah, the jujutsu master.
Yes.
Also human, but very obviously in-universe does not lose to guns.
Yes. So,
yeah, we're obviously looking above Kenichi, as the masters are just worlds apart from Kenichi.
Right. I'm inclined to believe he could quite easily take out a mech, very specifically the mech piloted by Gilbert Kent.
Yeah, I think he takes down Gilbert, sadly.
Yeah, let's move up a couple even. What about Hayate?
Hayate has that superhuman toughness and strength, but so does Akisame.
Right.
And Akisame probably has more battle experience because he's older.
And far more offensively.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's move up to the swordsmen then. We have Zoro Kenshin and Shishio. Just kind of tackle that in general. Versus great swordsman.
But he is shown to be, you know, fast. Certainly as fast as Kenshin, if not faster. And Kenshin is the speed demon of that group.
Mm-hmm.
He is shown to be strong. Probably as strong as Zoro, give or take. Maybe a little less. He is also shown to be really good against weapons. I mean, he has a counter for them.
Yeah, I think everybody in Kenichi can be said to be able to deal with swords that are on a realistic level. I think Zoro is a bit above that, but he still has at least physical stepping techniques where he just gets behind an enemy instantly and appears to be invisible to them.
Yeah, so, and I don't know
if Zoro has a real counter to that.
The jiu-jitsu allows him to take the swords away from Zoro, just pull them out of his hands.
And teeth.
Would the range come into it? Because Zoro does, you know, among these people, Zoro does have ranged attacks with his swords, with the 108-pound cannon, etc.
It's tricky. I would say that probably he'd be able to dodge ranged attacks just on the same rationale of being able to deal with actual guns.
Okay. Yeah, he can dodge bullets, so...
So then that even puts him above Ganta, or are these bullets so fast?
Ganta's bullets are fast. I would say that he never stands in front of Ganta for long enough for Ganta to fire anything at him.
Okay.
Ganta is a kid and rather inexperienced, so if it's just someone standing in front of him and he just has to fire a bullet, he could probably do so, but this is a highly trained martial artist we're talking about.
Right. Okay, so Edward Elric, then. This one's going to start to get interesting, I think.
I think.
Yeah.
Superhuman martial artist versus somebody who can modify terrain. I think that might be a kind of a bad matchup for him, because despite the fact that masters are shown to be able to deal with extremely diverse environments, Ed can sort of shift the terrain very much to his advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he could drop him into a humongous pit. Not that I'm saying Koetsuji would have a particular lack of problems like solving that. He might be able to somehow jump out of it.
They can all run up buildings, can't they?
Believe so. Which is ridiculous to think about, but yes. So if you think that's a matchup issue, the matchup would go to Ed. He would win. But let's look above towards someone that at least one more person knows. Let's look at Toriko, I suppose. Toriko, huge, brute strength, has a few techniques, but just very much power, power, power.
Yeah, I don't think he's as technical. Like, certainly Koetsuji has power, just it's very compact and compressed within his body. I think even with, like, the newly evolved Toriko, I think Koetsuji wins this one more on techniques.
He could kind of use Toriko's own strength against him, I would imagine, if nothing else.
Yeah.
Now, Rekka, this is the first legitimate, you know, pseudo supernatural fantasy type of power with the flame dragons and all that.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd put him above that. I think this is sort of where superhuman endurance has its limit.
Yeah, supernatural attacks aren't something you see in Kenichi, and I feel that that would be his limit, being attacked by, like, fire dragons.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Incidentally, while moving up the ranks here, we skipped over Nura Rikuo from Nurarihyo no Mago. He is in dire need of re-tiering, but we're going to wait until this arc is over, because he's just learning this new technique. So, we have not forgotten about him, but he will be re-tiered later. For now, though, Akisame is going above Toriko and below Rekka. Next on our list is Kyle from Siren. Kyle's ability is to be awesome. We're going to look a little bit higher than this, likely, because he is ultimately psychic.
Yeah, because he's got, like, psychically super enhanced powers, and he can make walls.
Yes. So, let's look at Luffy and compare him to Luffy. He can make walls. He has psychic enhanced power. Luffy is incredibly fast in Gear 2nd, incredibly strong, pardon me, in Gear 3rd. Not that he isn't strong just ordinarily. How would that play out in your opinion, Drew?
In my opinion, I almost think that, like, with him having building cracking, or being able to withstand building cracking punches, he might be able to stand up to Luffy, but not in Gear 2nd for a longer period of time.
Okay.
I think Luffy ultimately has the edge in that fight.
I would tend to agree, at least with what we've seen of Kyle so far. Let's jump down a few then. We ranked Gray, so let's compare him to Gray. Kyle versus Gray Fullbuster. Ice? Go ahead.
Ice? I think that might be a matchup issue for Kyle, because I'm not sure if he has an answer to being frozen. He's got an enhanced body, but that's more Shao's thing, to be able to break out of psychic binds and such like that.
Right. What about Tommy Rod, then?
Tommy Rod, I think this one goes to Kyle a bit more handily, because as much as Tommy Rod is superhuman and has bug minions, Kyle is extremely fast and capable of dealing with them. And he's fought actual monsters.
Right.
So even if Tommy Rod brings out his best bug, that's still going to go to Kyle, ultimately.
I think so, too. Ueki, then.
Ueki, then? I don't know if Kyle has an answer for a flying opponent that that has superhuman toughness and can launch god-killing bullets.
Yeah,
I don't think his walls are going to stop those, honestly.
So are we okay with putting him below Ueki, then?
Yep.
Okay, done. from Beelzebub, Furuichi Takayuki. Furuichi, as we mentioned in our current classic review of Beelzebub a couple weeks ago, the ultimate straight man, comedic straight man, I should delineate for you. We're looking, between Aizen and Hao, then?
Yeah. Wasn't Broken Tier unranked, though? Did I miss that?
Not Furuichi. He can be ranked.
Okay.
No. so he's essentially a delinquent, but he's not really a strong delinquent. He's pretty much an ordinary guy caught up with all these super strong delinquents. Although I would imagine that he has enough durability, having been around them, that he's probably gotten into a few fights himself. So he's certainly not a weak
fighting experience to an extent. Right.
So we're looking at least above Haruto. I think he could beat Haruto in a fight.
Yeah, I think he's obviously below Sanada, obviously above Haruto.
And then so it comes down to, can he beat two admittedly pretty weak kids?
Yeah.
It's 2-on-1, but he's certainly more fit.
I think, at the same time, he's not super fit, but I'd imagine that a capable delinquent could beat two weak artist kids 2-on-1.
I think so, too.
I would kind of give that one to Furuichi, yeah.
That's great. Furuichi beat two people.
Actually, three if you count
Actually, three people, because next up is Katsuragi Keima from The World God Only Knows. Guys, do we have a new worst character of the tier list?
I think so. Oh,
there are no girls on bottom tier to tier him above.
Our lowest currently tiered character is Kirishima Haruto from Kimi no Irumachi. He's just a regular kid, a regular college kid who can cook, basically.
He is not an otaku who is out of shape.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah, he walks places.
Yes.
Keima is an otaku, so everything that goes along with that.
Keima by himself, without any help from other characters, is our new worst character of the entire tier list. Fantastic.
Not in terms of comedy, just in terms of power.
Oh, clearly not. He's comedically fantastic, but in terms of power, sorry. So our top five is actually unchanged, but we've got several new additions in there. I'll get that updated on the website. And now it's time for us to move to This Week in Manga. If you have any comments on the segments that have preceded this one, or if you want to make any additions to our following one, please feel free to email in shonenbeam@gmail.com. And let's begin this week with Bleach Chapter 409, in which we get to see a modified Zangetsu.
Yeah, Zangetsu has transformed from the old man to the pretty boy fangirl fanservice character.
Since the last time we've seen him, it makes sense because the quality in Bleach has had an according drop. And now we have this formerly cool old man character now as a Bishi.
Yeah, Clint, I just want to point something out. Did you say the fan service character from Bleach?
No, that would be Hitsugaya.
Because I was going to say, aren't they all? this was actually fairly upsetting. He was one of the... Maybe his character design wasn't amazing, but it was certainly unique within Bleach. And that's been ruined. He just... Like, honestly, he just looks like Ukiyora now. Just without the weirdo skull
things. I kind of thought he looked close to Tatsuki, the female friend of Ichigo.
That's a good point. I didn't even think of that. You're right. That's an embarrassing statement.
So
about
he's
the
had a sex
art.
Change in the depths of Ichigo's soul in the meanwhile.
No, it just reveals that Tatsuki all along was Ichigo's Bankai.
That makes sense.
That makes perfect sense.
For the actual dialogue of the chapter, it seemed like a very obvious and poor attempt to be veiled at how the secret final technique is actually going to hurt either the person using it or the sword.
Yeah.
And there just doesn't seem to be a lot of depth to what's going on.
If it was a writer, it could be something along the lines of these, you know, the Zanpakuto are like the spirits of like a former opposing force that rivaled Soul Society, and they've been like enslaved and they don't want to be used as Bankai or something. Like, that's kind of the vibe that I got in terms of what it could have been from a cool artist, but I don't think that's going to happen.
It's going to be somehow dangerous, and he's going to use it one more time than is recommended.
Yeah. Ah, we know Shonen. That's depressing. So, yeah, it's essentially just training arc and very obvious foreshadowing as to some kind of conflict between Ichigo and Zangetsu, and that's about it.
Yeah, he's
yes?
learning the wind Rasen Shuriken.
Although, I mean, honestly, this is still not good, but it should be pointed out that so far, even though it's still bad, it's still better than the previous arc.
Yeah, well,
there's not too much that's worse than the previous arc, or even of the same quality level.
Yeah.
In terms of badness. Maybe, like, Sasuke just having close-up shots. But no, not even.
And then, presumably, next chapter, or maybe the chapter after, we're going to get to see Aizen coming down on Ichigo's friends here. What's up with this casual stroll? It's not menacing at all for him to just be, like, taking a walk in the park around this town.
Well, I guess when you're a character in our broken tier, you're not really scared of anything.
Well, but doesn't he have motivation to do anything? I just, that's the one thing that upsets me, is that this villain has absolutely no credibility in that he just kind of lets everything happen.
Of course, he doesn't have motivation. He's in Bleach.
I don't even want to be here today.
He just wants his Danish cookie.
Oh my, this Starbucks apparently. Alright, One Piece 589, which is the last chapter. We've been saying it all along, maybe this will be the last chapter of the flashback. This has been the last chapter of the flashback. We have one page, full page in present day. So this has been kind of the progression of time forward. I think that we both mentioned leading up to the show, Drew, that this is not at all what we expected to see in terms of a return to the present, but we were pleasantly surprised by that.
Yes, I was not expecting the way they eventually tackled how Luffy is in the funk that he is right now, and instead of just using the flashback to jolt him out of it, they're kind of just leaving him to say that all this optimism was misplaced, I really can't do any of this.
Right.
And just, even before the last full spread of I'm weak, the yeah, right, the page before really resonated with me as like a really effective sarcastic statement coming after all of this, and Sabo appears to be dead for real also.
Yeah, I mean, I still can't agree with that idea, but I totally agree with your points about the impact of Luffy still being absolutely destroyed over all of this. I'm still holding out hope that Sabo's going to show up pretty soon. Either to, you know, he can be the catalyst for Luffy cheering up, or he's going to involve Luffy in some kind of training arc, or he'll be the tie to the Revolutionary Army, something. I still get the feeling that he's around, but we'll see.
I kind of get the feeling that we've been set up for the greatest of shonen arcs, which is the training arc.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. Are we right about to face one? Are we on the precipice of a training arc?
I would think so.
I feel like we're going to have to get moving again somehow. And Luffy, one of the things I kind of liked about One Piece is that during Water 7, you didn't really have a training arc. You just had him thinking about it and then getting stronger. But if ever there was a place for a training arc, this is it.
I mean, in the war arc, we've showed off the staggering power of everyone standing at the top of the world. Like the admirals, we've seen how strong they are, how unmatched they are. So I think it's time now for Luffy to take a step forward and maybe make progress down the road of being able to fight with these people who were just absolutely taking over the war arc with their power. People on the level of Whitebeard and Blackbeard and the admirals.
Yeah, he's clearly nowhere near that level right now. He has the King's Haki. He has no idea how to use that right now. So It's going to be interesting to see because there's going to have to be a level up in power of some type, whether it's actually a formal training arc or just, like you mentioned, Drew, with Water 7, just kind of Luffy going along and figuring out some new way to use his power. Whatever it is, he is going to have to improve soon. You would expect that it would involve haki, and for it to use the haki, you would expect it to be a known user of haki teaching him.
And we have one readily available to us.
Being
in Boa.
True. Do you think that then she could end up being the mentor character for this arc rather than joining? Is that kind of her out?
I think she may, if she's going to teach him about haki, she may stay along with the crew. That would give her more of an excuse to actually be in the Straw Hats, I would think.
That's an interesting thought. I'm not sure I agree or disagree. That's a really interesting thought. Got to see Zoro, finally.
Yeah, in the flashback, it was pretty cool.
Brief little cameo, that was pretty cute.
Hopefully we'll see the Straw Hats for real, or else it'll go World of Ruin style, as we've been talking about.
Yeah,
that's what I'm really looking forward to, getting the crew back together, however he does it.
Oh, absolutely. That's by far and away what I'm looking forward to the most. That's, to me, the biggest reason why I think that there will be an actual training arc, because as far as we know, that's what all of the other crew members have been doing all this time. They've all been sent to places that are somehow relevant to them and their specialties or their abilities. And while they've been gone, we can only assume that they've been training. So it feels as though it's going to be time for Luffy to do the same.
Yeah, I mean, Luffy isn't the only one coming off of defeat. All of the crew was defeated by Kuma when we last saw them, so...
And Kizaru.
Yeah.
Wasn't just Kuma, fortunately. Although they probably still would have been, honestly.
Yeah, Kuma was the one who scattered them, probably, as for whatever reason, because his motivations still aren't clear, even after all of the war arc.
Right.
And the flashback.
Yeah, after the flashback, if anything, it's murkier now. Yeah, got to see Whoop Slap. That was great. Whoop Slap, the mayor, by the way, if you have no idea who I'm talking about. The mayor from Luffy's Old Town. We do not have a Naruto chapter this week. It is on break, so we will move now to Bakuman Chapter 91. Let's bask in the magnificence that was Chapter 91 of Bakuman. Holy hell, this was incredible.
Oh my gosh, it's everything you love about your favorite authors, just like... Fukuda being awesome, the hot-blooded shonen author.
Coming out of nowhere with Road Racer.
Yeah, very interesting. And then the scene at the end was just so completely like appropriate and well done and just moving, and then it got you going right again with the comedy right afterwards.
Yeah, as for, I mean, to me, the, you know, page 17, the full page shot of Mashiro presenting the rankings result to his uncle's grave. Moving, stunning, hugely enjoyable, also really unexpected. That took a very quick and unexpected turn over a couple chapters, because you thought that he was going to brag about this to Azuki, and he completely goes the other direction, and it takes a more somber, serious tone. He goes to the graveyard to show this. And then, yeah, you're totally right. It, immediately, if anyone can do really touching, beautiful moments transitioning immediately within a page to slapstick type of comedy, it's Bakuman, and it did it fantastically well. But, yeah, although the scene at the graveyard was the most touching and amazing scene, that's not the only cool scene. I really loved seeing all this stuff with Road Racer and the fact that Fukuda has now been re-legitimized as one of the main core group of mangaka in this series.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely someone that I can enjoy seeing more of. Him and his assistant are both, like, really, really funny to read.
Mm-hmm. And Kaya. This was a good Kaya chapter for her involvement. How she was peeking in on the guy reading in the store to see what he was reading. How she refused to be ignored.
Left in the background. She was, I was a part of this, too. I'm happy about it, too.
Yeah, I mean, this chapters like these are why I read this series.
Yeah, just excellently well done, every single page of it.
Yep. Beelzebub Chapter 66 was the flashback, Miki and Oga. Okay, this is flashback part two, because we got an earlier flashback with these two, and now this is, we're finally understanding what's going on. How do we feel about it? We'll get to the details of the entire chapter, but the most pressing thing is this misunderstanding at the end. How do we feel about this being the reasoning behind Miki's turn against Oga?
Oh, it makes sense. If I were rejected to that extent, I would be kind of mad too. But, like, in the context of Oga's character, it makes less sense, because it seems like he's pushing away Miki out of kindness, and that's something that's kind of out of character for him early in the series, which is after this flashback. So,
you know, I would disagree. I think he's always had the sense of camaraderie, at the very least. If he feels that he is, like, connected with someone, that they are a friend or a comrade to him, he will go out of his way, like him showing up on the rooftop to defend his friends from being thrown out of school. I think that is kind of the thing that he would do. And
I think earlier, though, you had a real problem with Oga just, like, not caring about other people and just being sort of callous about them. Just the fact that this is done seemingly out of kindness to Miki, I guess to me it seems out of place. It might fit more in with other conceptions of the manga.
No, I tend to agree with Clint, but I see your point. Let's go back over the other points of the chapter. So essentially, to cover what actually happened, it was that Miki was trying to retrieve a pendant or an amulet that he had left behind at their hangout, which turned out to be the hangout of, like, an older gang. And they, you know, proceeded to try to bully him. Oga comes and saves the day, and then because Oga saved the day by kicking all of their asses with a horribly evil face, which was great, you know, they continue to pester him at school and seek retribution, so you have the misunderstanding of Oga trying to push him away for his own sake, while Miki, rather unrealistically, in my opinion, takes it to heart, takes it the wrong way, and takes the pushing away seriously. Yes, it was established within this chapter that Miki was just seeking acceptance from Oga. But at the same time, just a couple chapters, a couple pages before Oga punches Miki away, he says he realizes he was aware of the fact that he was ignoring him and pretending not to know him for his own sake. So, I don't know, it just seemed bizarre that he was kind of overlooking knowledge that he had already accepted to be true.
Yeah, maybe a little contrived for the sake of a fight.
Yeah,
I think it's just because Oga doesn't really know when to stop.
That's evident. Yes,
especially earlier on, he just beats people and doesn't stop, and especially since Miki kept coming back to him.
Right.
He had to do something to push him away before he got really hurt.
I don't know. It's an acceptable explanation. I mean, I'm okay with it, but it's not really impressing me either.
Yeah, I mean, the chapter itself was enjoyable. It's just, in the context of Oga's overall character, I'm not sure how it fits in.
Right. All right. Fairy Tale, chapter 189. Where willpower, yeah. Wow,
willpower stalls while Mistgun wins.
Pretty much. So we have Panther Lily acting as the foil, you know, the typical shonen character that doesn't believe anything is possible and can't understand why the protagonists are fighting because it's all useless and you're just going to die, and then, you know, eventually this character is going to see the light of day and join up with Gazeel probably. Until he gets shot in the chest.
That was good. Although, like, it probably won't lead to anything.
That was good, except if you examine the art of him getting shot through the back and chest, look at his face. It doesn't look like a pained expression so much. It looks like... It looks a lot more hilarious than evoking sympathy from me for being shot through the chest.
Fairy Tale does melodrama? What?
it looked pretty... I suspend disbelief enough to get into this series. And, you know, truth be told, I'm not a huge fan of the series, but I'll get into it. But, yeah, that really broke me out of the Fairy Tale reading mood. It looked so out of place, his facial expression, while getting shot. I don't know. Maybe that was just me. But that was really the grand scheme of the chapter. You also have the Panther Lily flashback where... he saved... I got weird parallels to Dalton from One Piece from this. He saved the young prince character that turns out to be Mistogan. Which, okay, whatever. How do you guys feel about or you guys? This is only Drew. How do you feel about Mistgun?
I think it's interesting that they have just a pure badass character in Fairy Tail who's actually really strong and doesn't immediately get shown up for like power of friendship needs to be saved by the main character. But it's very negligible in Fairy Tail compared to other series that do it better, like Kakashi and Siren.
Right.
So I like him like with an asterisk, and he has some good scenes, but he's just not enough of that. Fairy Tail needs more of Mistgun, I guess is what I'm saying. So
yeah,
I like him.
That's the biggest problem. I like the concept that that Natsu is not the strongest character in Fairy Tail, meaning Fairy Tail the Guild within the series Fairy Tail. I like that there are other strong characters, even on the quote-unquote good side. But from a storytelling perspective, that's where I take the real issue, because we haven't seen him to be good or very strong. We're just being told constantly at how strong he is. That's not how to weave a narrative. You don't just say this person is strong. You show it through action. And we've had very, very little of that. There needs to be considerably more.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even looking for him to show off his powers as much. I'm looking for him, like, another scene back during the Phantom Lord arc. At the very end of it, when everybody's wondering why he wasn't doing anything, and he just scatters all the flags of all the side guilds of Phantom Lord.
Right. Unusual character. I don't know. I could use improvement in some capacity. I'm okay with him being around, but just a little more exposition. Just being a little more present, even if he's not doing too much, just for him to be around.
Yeah, I can see that.
Overall, then, Bizarro Erza comes in. She's going to finish her fight, presumably, and you have... it seems to be setting up all of the creatures that are falling behind the evil Erza are going to fight with all these cats that are now going to fight for their homeland. Does it seem that way to you?
It seems that way, unfortunately. Like, the chapter upcoming does not give me a lot of optimism.
No. Well, there could be decent...
To say none. If all the cats get speared...
Yes.
By one attack.
I'm okay with this. If they just drop the entire floating continent on all these cats, series redeemed. All right, moving on. Hayate no Gotoku 277. We had some comedy to this chapter. Really, the most important part of this chapter is at the end when Hayate devises a plan for them to sell their really uninviting rooms, because, you know, price and accommodations certainly do not stack up against other apartment rooms in the area, but Hayate's idea is that this is the only apartment complex that comes with a butler. So how do you feel about that idea going forward, Glenn?
Yeah, it's a pretty good idea, and I mean it's acceptable to believe, because Hayate was cleaning all of the humongous mansion with only help from Maria before, so now he's cleaning something significantly smaller. They could definitely list it as a service, and it's going to be interesting.
Right.
Especially when I kind of feel like the tenants of this apartment are going to be characters that we're familiar with.
It seems that way. Yeah, you pointed that out to me earlier. I agree. It very strongly seems that way, which I don't disapprove of, really. I mean,
yeah.
Who do you think it's going to be? Do you think it's going to be the girl from his old school?
Maybe her, maybe Hinegiku. Possibly some of, like, Nagi's friends staying there sometimes, like Sakuya.
Mm-hmm. Sakuya, perhaps. I don't think Izumi as much.
Yeah.
She seems fine where she is. But yeah, I mean, that could provide interesting additional spotlight for some of the side characters that haven't gotten it as much, because it seems as though the kinds of characters that would be able to move in are the kinds of characters that haven't had enough spotlight. For the most part, I mean, obviously Hina has had a ton of spotlight, but... Yeah, she seems poised to move out from her parents' place, her parents' modest place. And then the ordinary girl, I think, is a strong contender for moving in here.
Yeah.
But
and
yeah,
also,
yes.
I wanted to point out that, like, now Nagi was pointing out that she has the 20 million still left over, and they didn't need to use it, and her first thought was investing it into stocks. Which is what I originally thought that her plan was going to be, her mad money-making scheme, would be stocks. And what I'm looking for now is a couple gags in the future chapters where she's just making ridiculous tons of money from business expertise.
It would be fun. Do you think that we're going to stay in this this location long, or are we going back to the mansion?
I think we're going to stay here for a while, at least a good while.
Okay. All right, moving right along. Kakashi, chapter 311. Drew, take her away.
Yeah, well, you see a lot of the different Uruk-hai power users, and they're kind of all assholes in different ways. One of them's a necromancer. The other one's, I don't care if our own people get hurt. The other one is resurrecting two, not just one, but two Kurokabuto, which is kind of retro. You haven't seen any of those for about 3 years. But, yeah, he's resurrecting two Kurokabuto. And then the chapter ends with just the founders, like, thinking, okay, you want to ride those demons that are currently on the enemy side? And then he just drops a whole crap ton of snakes everywhere. Masamori seems like he was the only one ready to deal with that. So just by the appearance of the chapter, it looks like Masamori is the only one who's not going to be a brainwashed zombie at the end of this chapter.
Seems as though, which I'm okay with, actually. I mean, I loved this chapter from the standpoint of just, like, if you like shonen because you like seeing interesting attacks and powers, boy, was this a chapter. This was really cool, just seeing all the variety. But also, yeah, the attitudes of all these different Uruk-hai members. I don't know. I can totally agree with your train of thought here. Which, if that's the case, then if Masamori is just going to be then alone in still being, you know, clear-headed against all of these people, what's the course of action?
I have no idea where Kakashi's going to go right now. And if that's the chapter does end with at least some people resisting the attack and falling back, it leads to perhaps a really interesting conclusion, but it definitely feels like Kakashi is in the middle of a climax arc, especially going straight from the assault on the Ogi house to this.
Yeah.
And then immediately having big events happening in large-scale battles. This is a very fast-paced series right now, and I'm convinced that it's headed for a fairly major climax.
I could see that, because also, once Yoshimori completes his training and uses the technique for which he's been training, what else is there to do after that incident where he uses it and then the immediate results of it? There's not too much left, really, is there?
There's the main villain has to be dealt with, and possibly Michiru Kakeru for future arcs. She's still going to try to blow up the world.
True.
But there really isn't a whole lot left, and the overarching plot of the entire story has been him trying to seal Karasumori the Lord in a permanent position. So,
true.
It'd be really interesting to see whether or not he does that before or after the main villain gets beat. Because it doesn't look like it's going to be a bad guy win series. And also, when is Tokine going to show up again?
Yes.
It's kind of about time.
It's definitely about time. Do you think she's going to be... Well, she'll definitely be improved. How improved do you think she's going to be?
What she's doing right now is training for, like, the equivalent of Yoshimori's blank stage, so she's going to be pretty more powerful. I'd like to see her get some sort of power that somehow complements the Zekai, but is not the Zekai. It'd be kind of weak if she just got that, but there are a lot of interesting ways they could take her power, because Yoshimori's sort of a wide area range power. Hers is a very precise striking power. I'm interested to see how they develop her, because she's obviously going to have a power-up beyond just stronger Kekai.
Yeah, so optimistic from here on out, I take it?
Oh, I'm looking forward to it very much.
All right. History's Strongest Disciple Kenichi, chapter 387, which is just full-on pornography.
I know you guys didn't like Seikon no Quasar. I can understand why. This is basically the chapter that is one of the reasons why I dropped Seikon no Quasar. For those of you who don't know, it's a very fanservice-y action show from the Winter Doten season.
Yeah,
I know that this trend with Kenichi can't continue, because when we move on to the other Master's fights, we're obviously not going to have any fanservice, so maybe he's just trying to get in his fill of fanservice, but this was frankly ridiculous. Like, the level to which this was done was just unacceptable. It was distracting from the fight. I couldn't even focus on the fight.
Yeah, I mean, it's really depressing to me. I was really looking forward to this fight, just from a pure fight standpoint. It was really set up to be very interesting. And granted, even within this chapter, there were some really excellent scenes when she's standing on the motorcycle, which is doing a wheelie the opposite direction that people do wheelies. Like, that was really cool. There were some really cool scenes. But all of those cool scenes featured topless Shigure. And okay, yes, haha, everyone loves nudity, but time and place. This was not at all appropriate for what was supposed to have been a serious fight.
Yeah.
I don't know, is there that much more to
I don't
say
know. I
about this?
guess I was able to follow the action, but I'm just looking forward to other master fights more. Even like with this fight having been what it was, it still doesn't really kill my expectations for the next couple of fights.
Well, yeah, I'm certainly looking forward to the upcoming fights, but I would have loved for this fight to have been more climactic and better done with less fan service.
Right. Looking at finalizing this fight, though, is the knight a girl?
I think we're going to see that.
Would
I
make
think
sense.
that's fairly obvious if we don't just like leave this setting entirely next chapter.
Right. Okay. Toriko, chapters 98 and 99 were released this week. So we have in 98 the aftermath, the direct aftermath of finalizing the Century Soup.
AKA Penguin Drooling.
Yeah, of course. I put that in my soup all the time. And this is a fantastic chapter for Komatsu, who has really needed an increase in relevance. He has been kind of the lackey, he's just been following in Toriko's shadow. And certainly he's still not at that level of notoriety and notability, but he is now world renowned for creating this Century Soup. His hotel's rating, his restaurant's rating, has gone from 5 stars to 6 stars. He has people coming in from all around the world to try it. I mean, people know him, and even one of the professional tasters who came in recommends that he get a bodyguard now. So, yeah,
Which
really,
could be
really
a
great.
character we already know, too.
Yeah, now who are you thinking? Because I was thinking Rin.
I was thinking Rin also. Like, it's
Excellent.
just the most obvious choice to reintroduce her into the story.
That would be fantastic. Are you missing her as much as I am?
I think definitely, especially that gives her an excuse to tag along with Toriko.
Yeah.
And that was still, there are a lot of great comedy moments in Toriko. One of the best was how Rin survives at the end of the Mammoth Arc. And I'm looking forward to more of that kind of thing.
I had forgotten about that. Yeah, I hope that's her. I mean, ultimately, it could just be Toriko, like, just sticking around him all the time, but it would be nice to see, Rin add a dynamic to that little grouping. And then we also have Chapter 99, which is the big shocking announcement at the end of Chapter 98 is revealed more so in Chapter 99, which is Toriko wants to add Komatsu's Century Soup to his full course, which is a huge event in the grand scheme of this series. And in 99, Komatsu accepts and decides he's not going to, was it patent, trademark, copyright?
He's not going to release the recipe
Right.
because then wall penguins would get hunted to extinction.
Right. So he's going to keep the secret of the recipe to himself, which means that he's going to be targeted, so you actually get to see him confident and determined to retain his position and to maybe not be Toriko's equal, but certainly more of a partner than just a tag along. So I really liked this in terms of character development for Komatsu.
What I liked about this chapter is they showed Komatsu's restaurant, which was originally 5 stars, go up to a 6-star level of restaurant, and that looking at the number of open spaces left on Toriko's main course, it doesn't match up exactly, but if the restaurants in Toriko can go up to 10 stars in terms of ranking, and that would pace pretty well for Komatsu to cook up every ingredient that isn't like God for
Right.
Toriko's main course, which
That
I
does make
think
sense.
works very well.
That's a very good thought. I had not thought of that, but very, very possible scenario.
Every time he invents a legendary dish, the restaurant goes up a star, and then it's a 10-star restaurant at the end of the series.
Right, and that would
Makes
probably account for
sense.
everything but God. You're right. God, by the way, for anyone who doesn't follow but is still listening, God is the name of a food.
Which
So,
stopped World War III.
canon. This is why we read Toriko. Seriously, it's a great series. And then at the end of chapter 99, we get into Aimaru and the disease principal diet and explaining why it is that the soup was being taken to him. And you see Aimaru get his spirits back up after hearing that Toriko is chasing after God. It was interesting. I don't know.
That was interesting. The whole concept of a guy who eats disease certainly fits
like
in
that.
With Toriko as a world, as a world with people with unique cells who can eat anything.
Right. And at the very end, you had Sani training with Yosaku, albeit, you know, by training, mostly he was just getting beat down. But
he was lying on the floor. Although that could actually be an attack strategy with him, using it to better ground his hair.
It's like Frankie's ultimate defense.
Oh, the Oh, man, I forgot about that.
Frankie Invincible?
Yeah.
Not at all like that, but yeah, good to see that Sani is being explored as a character a little bit more, because, you know, the four Heavenly Kings were kind of put to the side for all of this Ice Hell thing, and, you know, it's not to say I didn't enjoy Ice Hell. Certainly I loved Ice Hell, but, you know, the four Heavenly Kings they're interesting enough of characters that they deserve some more exposition.
Yeah, I think certainly Zebra is the one they still have to introduce. Coco's had a fair amount of development.
Right.
Sani, too, during the Regal Mammoth arc. And Zebra is the one that's really waiting, and they've given us a lot of hints about him. He may be due up for an arc.
That'd be pretty cool. But, yeah, I'm sure that there is a reason why he's been held off for so long.
Yeah. I mean, he's been foreshadowed even before Sani was, but...
Yeah.
Just as a guy who is now in prison for doing some unspeakable thing. And it quite clearly, unlike when he's just in prison for doing something stereotypically rebellious, it's pretty obvious he did something that's actually, like, bad.
Yeah.
He's Although, been bad.
Bad in the concept of Toriko could be, like, stealing eggs or something. Who knows? All right, moving on. The World God Only Knows, chapter 103, where it's a date that's not really a date, but it's enough of a date to achieve the intended effect, and also fire trucks.
Yeah, mainly fire trucks. I kind of like the chapter title, Devil May Try. The best part was obviously just the scene where Elsie encounters five different fire trucks and just having boatloads of fun over one page with them.
God, that is such a fantastic character trait in all of manga, not just this one series. What a great idea. That's always so funny.
Fits extremely well. That's the one thing I'm most looking forward to seeing animated, and it looks like subsequently, Elsie's got her confidence back, and we're ready to start on whatever the next arc is going to be.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this was supposed to have been a very short kind of refresher arc, but it's done the job. It was not excellent, but it was certainly not bad. It's achieved the intended goal, and we're going to move on. So let's also move on. Chapters 292 and 293 of Maho Sensei Negima. Clint, you want to give us a bit on that?
Yeah, these chapters were... Negi finally finished his power-up, and now they're, like, charging towards Fate's Castle, and they're developing, like, their battle plan. And then towards the end of 292, the crazy girl who uses swords shows up. What's her name?
Tsukiyomi, I think.
Yeah, Tsukiyomi. She shows up and challenges Negi, and we are shown that Negi is on a completely different level now. He's completely powered up past some of the stronger characters in the series.
Yeah, he's clearly got a job as a waiter because he just delivered a full course of pone.
Did you stay up all late last night thinking of that one?
I did, thank you very much. He just sort of completely got behind a character who's shown to be pretty fast and just grabbed them by the throat in a great scene.
He can't even be cut anymore. Like, she chopped his arm in half, and apparently he's fine with that now.
Yeah, I would like to point out...
He's got, like, the Inaru immunity to stuff.
He has a psycho gun. That's what that was. He has Cobra's psycho gun, but it's magic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
How cool is that? Now, that actually adds a really interesting element. I mean, it's certainly not as though Negi didn't have ranged attack. God, he's practically all ranged attack, but he didn't really have a ranged physical attack. And it's interesting that now he can kind of like phase. He can choose what type of attack to use at any distance now.
Yeah. He can kind of punch people or grab people from a distance.
Yeah.
That's why he's high tier.
and then just teleport to where his dislocated hand was. I mean, Negi hasn't even reached the finish of his evolution. He may wind up higher than he is.
Oh, yeah, God, of course it's going to happen.
Climax of the series is going to put him pretty high. I don't know if it's Jack Rackin high, but certainly these two chapters showed him being pretty darn powerful. And also some great satire in these chapters when they set up, like, how are we going to have to do this, set this up? They're going over, like, how each opponent is going to be fought in succession.
Yeah, like, which opponents are going to appear first.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. But both a send-up of other fantasy type of action series, and I also got vibes of making fun of RPGs, because already this, you know, the entire, like, fantasy action world arc of Negima very much feels like an RPG with all the different cast of very specialized characters, and, you know, certainly a tower with enemies on every level and the final boss at the end. Boy, if that doesn't scream RPG or even just video games in general, what does?
Yeah.
That was enjoyable. Anything else from those two chapters?
We do get to see one of the girls who finally got a Pactio using her guns.
But it was only the one gun. It was only the normal-looking gun.
Well, yeah, you have to save that for her actual fight.
Yeah.
And then we saw... Yes?
Well, she's kind of like a background character. I'm not sure if she's ever going to have an actual fight.
Right.
I think she has backstory that has yet to be elaborated on, like her parents being like magical and they didn't fully explain things, like they kind of people got cut off while they were saying things about her parents, so we've yet to see some things about her.
Mm-hmm. It's possible.
All right, Siren chapter 124 then. Let's do Siren. First of all, not actual in-story related, but worth mentioning that Siren is receiving a novelization, which is fantastic news, because Siren is, you know, Siren is worrisome, to put it in one way, for its fans, because it continually finds itself in the bottom five of the Shonen Jump table of contents. So any kind of adaptation, any positive news, is even more positive, because we need anything to grasp onto to keep us confident that the series will not be canceled. So a novel adaptation. Good.
Truly, if Siren ends at the point that it's at, there are so many plot threads unresolved right now.
Oh, this would hurt so badly. So badly.
Even worse than Double Arts.
Yeah, because there's been more development. Yeah, this would be terrible. But anyway, as to the actual meat of this chapter, this is the unfortunate passing away of Tenjuin Elmore. Found it some pretty strong scenes in here. The way that it was affecting Shao in particular... really, really painful to watch Shao reacting. You know, anytime you have a character second-guessing themselves, you know, oh, I could have done this, and maybe that would have prevented this situation from happening.
Yeah, the typical hero dilemma. Like, maybe if I had killed him, like, my friends would still be alive.
Right.
Like, certainly, Shao delivers a powerful line. If I had smashed all of his bones and crushed his heart, was an extremely powerful line, and of course goes in line with the kind of opponents they're facing, who are extremely tough people.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we had pretty much pinned Vigo for dead. Like, we didn't really think about that. We never mentioned it when he was out. We pretty much assumed that he'd be gone, and good to see that, you know, the author, Toshiaki, just kind of threw us for a loop there with him not just being alive, but coming back strong and kidnapping Marie. And affecting Elmore so strongly. So that's, first of all, a testament to the author, but then second of all, yeah, you're absolutely right. For to leave Shao in this condition shows the seriousness of the villains.
Mm-hmm. And especially, it shows they know what they're doing, because I mean, I could have brought this up last chapter, but I kind of just realized it now, but they're losing both their mother, Elmore, and Marie at the same time, who was technically filling the leader role for the Root Society. So how they move on from this is, I guess, very ambiguous, but it seems Ageha's going to have to step up as a leader.
Yeah, this is actually a pretty crushing defeat. A lot worse than we anticipated, certainly early on, because we thought Shao had won pretty clearly. You know, he got hurt during the battle, but, you know, pretty decisive win by the end of it. Kyle was holding his own, and then all of a sudden everything just took a turn for the worse. So I guess we never really realized it until right now, but... Yeah, pretty conclusive defeat all across the board. So not that there isn't hope to be found in it, though. You know, ultimately,
yeah, they've still got another base they're reestablishing, which is good to hear. They're not taking out the root entirely, but
right,
the Y's definitely got the best of them this one by taking out their leadership and kidnapping or killing half the populace.
Right. So now we're setting up for this rescue arc, but first we're going to have to be subjected to a training arc, which has been a long time coming, really, because in all of the action, which has been fantastic, I mean, I've loved seeing Frederica and Kyle and Shao and all this going on, but ultimately, Yoshino was kind of pushed to the background, and you know, we can't have that from our main character, so he's approached his dad, Asuka, to learn whatever it is that Asuka does, and I'm sure we're going to find out next chapter what it is he does.
So, yeah, that's something to look forward to, and obviously, at the end of it, he's going to emerge a stronger hero, probably take a role in the rescue mission they're mounting, which, again, looks to be really cool. They're going to have to split up into two parties to make it work.
Yep.
And it looks like something that could deal a pretty critical blow to the Wise. So even beyond changing the future, if they can take out the Wise in the future, they can probably do it in the present.
Yeah, that was rather interesting. I also liked the attitude that everyone took up. You know, Shao showing off, like, "Oh, I'm glad that you guys need me." He did ultimately snap out of it, or use his depression as fuel for revenge at this point. And Frederica showing strong determination. I'm increasingly every single chapter, I'm more and more impressed by Frederica stepping up as more of a main character and more relevant and important and powerful as a character.
So she's interesting enough to watch. I don't really know enough about her to give positive or negative judgment, but she's probably the most powerful of the kids, just in terms of sheer destructive potential.
Right. But yeah, gonna be a good rescue arc, I would imagine. Certainly very excited about where this series is going. Please don't get canceled. That would be so harsh. I think that there's enough of a buffer zone in Jump that, you know, at least Madoka, I would imagine, would get canceled before this, but boy, that would be terrible.
Speaking of something that's probably never going to get canceled.
Hajime no Ippo, Chapter 898. All right, so this we're finally away from this fight entirely. We're moving on. We're taking a look at, initially we're taking a look at just, you know, playfulness and lighthearted romantic comedy type of stuff between Ippo and Kumi and you know, the love triangle going on there, but then also looking a lot of introspection from Itagaki. Rather interesting chapter from his standpoint, would you agree?
I would say it's a fairly interesting Itagaki chapter. You really see his own envy being manifested here. Mm-hmm. In previous times, he had it pretty obviously, but refused to admit it. But just here, you see he's actually openly admitting to Mari that he's very envious of the position that Ippo has. Mm-hmm. He's the champion, and he has the girl that Itagaki sort of fell in love with. So
I think he kind of set a goal for himself that was interesting. I'm wondering how he'll do in this coming fight, trying to win faster than Ippo did.
That's going to be pretty hard. I'd be a little disappointed if he easily does it. Ippo won as quickly as he did, and it was a curb stomp because of the training that Ippo had specifically done. It's going to be hard for a fighter of Itagaki's type to repeat that.
Yeah, I agree. And also, not even just from the technical aspect that you brought up, but just from the entire concept of, you know, the fight that we've been complaining about for so long, you know, among the myriad of ways we could complain about it, I think one of the worst things that it did was really emasculate and weaken our concept of Ippo as a character. For then, again, for Itagaki to turn around and weaken Ippo even further by beating his record would really be insulting.
I think yeah. Itagaki's due for another smack in the face wake-up call.
Yeah.
I see him winning the fight, but by not within his goal, and I think that would make most sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and also I'd like to point out, Ippo doesn't have so much of a love triangle as a love square going on now with that reporter, Itagaki's sister, and Kumi all being after him.
The reporter is interesting. She has a longer history than Itagaki's sister, certainly.
Yeah.
And she actually got the first autograph back in the day.
That's true. All right, Arago, chapters 24 and 25. Drew, you want to give us some on that?
Seth volunteers to be, I guess, like a police trash boy or something, and apparently he can do that. So I guess him turning himself in just ended up being a community service sort of deal.
Seems like it. That was kind of not explained and also strange.
Yeah, that sort of felt out of place to me. Like, the actual conversation between Seth and Argo, Argo sort of being reluctant to ally, but Seth looking increasingly like he's serious about teaming up.
Right.
If anything, Argo seems the one more likely to break up the pairing at that point.
Well, it's got to be hard for him to trust him still at this point.
Yeah, because you've already seen him deceive Argo seriously once,
mm-hmm.
albeit before Argo knew about the horn. And then we see Coco and Koro, the particularly interesting one being the girl that has the giant heart aura.
Oh, I want to see so much more of her. This has been... She made these last two chapters for me. She was absolutely fantastic. This is what there needed to be in terms of a dynamic. It shouldn't be explored too seriously. I mean, it does need to be kind of the comic relief, but it's really cute, and it provides something new to the dynamic between the main cast of characters. So I hope that she'll be around, maybe not a prominent role, but at least around enough to have impact on, you know, the relationship between Arago and Rio, even.
Mm-hmm. It's looking by, like, the way things are going, like, the way the dog seems to have spiritual senses, it seems
right.
like she may eventually be a part of special crimes, dealing with supernatural cases and the like.
Do you think
so
that she could potentially find out about Argo's power because of that then? And then she would have to keep quiet.
Her finding out about Argo's power would be an interesting twist. I'm not sure if I'd be for or against it. I'd have to see it be done.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, absolutely the dog is aware of what's going on, but if she's at all attuned with the dog, which we've yet to really see, because
she has some sort of aura, at least.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's just a personality thing.
Right.
Also, the whole Joe groping thing, great page. Just him, he comes
to
feel from Rio, and then the next page just runs by three women all at the same time.
That was brilliant. I love Joe. He's fantastic.
And then Doppelganger's just looking fondly in the background. He's like, I want to do it too.
Yeah, I mean, certainly not the best Arago chapters we've read recently, but still, continuously impressed by this series. Again, this is chapter 25 now of this series, very young as a series, and yet one of the more solid, one of the more enjoyable series that we discuss, or at least that I read.
It has a very solid sense of direction at this point, which for a shonen manga in its early chapters is very impressive.
Right.
And it manages to entertain from week to week, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good ending, chapter 39. Oh, boy.
Not a good ending to this chapter. More like just Onoma's boobs take a stand for romance.
Yeah, it's a setup to a good ending. My God. Okay, so we have all this... You know, the recent serious turn in plot where Seiji is kind of examining himself, and he was in the room in a sort of intimate situation with Yuki, and it went from that, you know, stereotypical harem type of setup to him realizing that he doesn't know what he wants to do with his future. Really, you know, serious introspection from a character in a romance comedy. And then, oh hey, by the way, this is still a harem series to some extent. Have you ever done it? And like, she falls on him in the dark and is trying to make a move on him.
It still doesn't feel as bad as it's felt in some other series. But
oh, no.
That was definitely a huge step down from where this series has been going. I think the harem aspects of Good Ending have been one of the weaker parts of it. But still better than an average harem, but not good in comparison to the introspection in the main character and the main romance.
I agree. I mean, the Seiji Yuki is what needs to happen. It's what I want to see happen. I'm okay with Onuma being a part of this love triangle. First of all, it has to just be a love triangle. Shosenpai needs to be out of the picture at this point. I totally agree with Seiji's female friend who's trying to steer him on track and be less nice to Sho, you know, and put her behind you. It's going to hurt Yuki. Totally agree with that. I don't necessarily think that that's what's going to happen, unfortunately, but that's what needs to happen. I'm okay with Onuma still being there, and frankly, I'm even okay with her using her body, using her sexuality, but I don't want it to just be for the, you know, the face value effect. Is it just me? Does she seem really overly nervous to you? More so nervous than just a girl who's making a move on a guy, but like seemingly anxious, not at all okay with herself, with what she's doing.
But she really seems like Sawako from Kimi no Todoke. Like, this is the one series I feel I can really draw a shoujo analogy to, but she seems like she's just, even before being, like, nervous about talking to the guy, she's just generally socially a little bit inexperienced, a little bit awkward, and that's kind of what it feels like, and it makes sense in context, but this turning, if this turns into a big fan service scene, I will not like it. Like, up till now, it's been, I guess, it's been more shoujo-y in the way they developed Onuma as a character, and they just need to limit how much they take the fan service in these next couple chapters in order to make it good.
Yeah, I totally agree with you there. I'm okay with a little bit. You know, obviously, ultimately, the series also has to sell with demographics, so it's a necessary evil at points. But even if it's not just, even if you're not looking at it from that standpoint, I'm okay with some, but it needs to not be the focus. There needs to be, for her to be, in my eyes, legitimized as part of this love triangle, she needs to have some kind of legitimate emotional and sensible aspect. We need to be able to see into her character more than just falling on him in the darkness and trying to make a move.
I think her character has been given sophisticated aspects that need to be emphasized.
Yeah.
And hopefully will be in the next chapter. I'm not still totally pessimistic about it, but it's not a favorable direction for the chapter to go in.
Right. We'll talk about a not favorable direction. Lock-On 17 and 18 are the last two chapters of the series because it's been canceled, as we mentioned earlier. So we'll take a look at the series and then briefly look back on it. So what a way to end your series. The last little mini arc is Nico's former karate teacher turns out to be a groper who likes to grope girls. And Utsuru finds out about it, and Nico trusts him and kicks the former teacher. That wraps up chapter 17.
Beats the grope with her hope, essentially.
How do you feel about this storyline to wrap up a series?
To wrap up a series, it gives you a miniature sense of revolution in that, like, resolution, and that the main thing about the main character's personality has been somewhat resolved. But there's a lot of cheese here.
Yeah. It especially hurt me because, you know, last week, Lock-On Chapter 16, we had the flashback, the serious examination of a really poignant moment in Utsuda's past. Really well done. I mean, we were going on, at least I was, about how excellent it was, not just as a Lock-On chapter, but just overall. And then to immediately follow that up with a groper. Yes, you got to see a little peek into the window of the growing trust between Nico and Utsuru, and that was kind of nice, but it was, you know, I had to infer most of the niceness from that because they didn't really focus on that too much. It was more focusing on the actual groping and the evil guy and Nico kicking him. A disappointing direction, especially when you consider that this is the end of the series.
It wasn't particularly exceptional. It was kind of, I feel like this, if it had been slower, it would have made more sense.
Mm-hmm.
That
was the biggest problem. Is that it carried no impact, because if it had been a character from her past that we got to meet and befriend and understand that he's a legitimately good character, and then it's revealed, you know, over the course of several weeks, then it's revealed that he's actually this terrible person, then it carries weight, and I'd be okay with it. But to introduce it and resolve it within a chapter just does not work.
I feel like it's just kind of forced because they had to have a conclusion.
Yeah.
And I feel, as much as I don't have a high opinion of the series as a whole, I feel kind of sorry for Lock-On because it was getting a bit better towards the middle, towards the very end of it. It had some interesting chapters. It had the chapter with the film club guy, the newspaper guy, who was at least interesting setup. It had been introducing more characters seemingly in setup for a larger arc, but it just wasn't going to survive, and we knew that. So
yeah,
it's not that good, but it had potential that it would never realize.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, ultimately, the biggest flaw, though, is the art. I mean, for all of the promise that we can imagine, would Tsuchida ever have pulled it off with that kind of art? Unfortunately, no. It was just not acceptable for a major shonen magazine.
And we saw that pretty clearly with its rankings in the table of contents. While it was higher than certain other things, it still just wasn't performing well enough in the market. Ultimately, if it sells well, it's going to do well, no matter how bad it is.
Yeah.
As looking back at the first manga of the week we discussed earlier.
Yes. I can't remember which one that was. And then chapter 18, the final chapter, is the brief resolution of the entire little mini Groper arc, and then ultimately, you know, what you would expect out of any, you know, last chapter of any series that has been canceled is just fairly open-ended resolution. There's really only two ways you can go with a series that's canceled that has to end before its time was intended, and it's either an open ending where it's just, you know, you can picture that these characters are going to continue to be themselves to
a
the indefinite future.
Picture.
Yeah, into the great beyond, or they hurriedly rush a forced ending. Of the two options, he went for the open ending, and I prefer that, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
And just, how do you feel? I mean, Nico admits her love for Utsuru, and that's kind of where it resolves. Are you okay with that as an ending for
I guess,
chapter series?
I'm okay with that for an ending. Like, it's not blowing me away, but it's not really losing any more points than Lock-On has already lost.
Right.
It was fine, I guess.
Yeah. So, 18 chapters, it's done. Certainly not at all exceptional, not even really good as a whole, but, you know.
It showed a little bit of potential towards the end, not a lot of potential. It still was kind of bad.
It was pretty bad. Yeah, there's no but. I take that back. There is no, like, amazing positive or anything. There's no great lesson to be learned here. This series was bad. It deserved to be canceled. The end. And then finally, the last
group. Something Triple Arts, like, coming in the next couple of days.
Oh, my. I'm kind of looking forward to the new series, honestly. We'll see. Hopefully we'll get good scanlations of them.
We'll say, at least. Mm-hmm. Although it looks to be sort of similar to a lot of series we already have.
I'm more excited for the Zoo one, to be perfectly honest, having read both of the one-shots, but we'll see. Again, we'll read about it. We'll discuss it right here on the show. And then finally, the last series we're going to discuss as a group is Metallica, Metallica 6. This is, again, setting up to take the Minea entrance exam, which is probably going to be some kind of tournament or large series of battles or something. And you find out about Luca's dad, who is this renowned Minea, apparently.
Pretty manly badass, frankly.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
See, the first thing he does, he just, like, shoots a corkscrew of metal through a lava pit.
Yeah, that was pretty awesome. This series has yet to really blow us away on any note. That was probably the coolest moment we've seen so far, wouldn't you say?
Oh, aside from the scene where, like, Zuo is getting smothered by boobs upside his head.
Okay.
That was definitely the high point of this series so far.
Yeah.
More flashbacks of his dad, or just him doing the same thing. Or just him growing a beard.
Yeah.
The same thing.
Perfect.
It was a decent chapter, I would say.
Clint, did you read 6?
Yeah. We're moving towards the exam might establish this series as being something, but I'm still kind of like, I'm so neutral on it. It has yet to take me either way.
Yeah. It's really hard to formulate an opinion. It needs to do so very, very soon, though, because in the same issue as which Lock-On is going to receive its... Yotsuya will receive its final chapter, the bottom five of the Table of Contents in Shonen Jump include both Shonen Shiku, which is a new sports series in Shonen Jump, and this series, Metallica Metallica. For it to already be in the bottom five on... That will be, I believe, its seventh week. So chapter 7, that is a very, very poor sign. So it needs to grab our imagination immediately.
Yeah. Thing is, like, especially going into Jump nowadays, you have a very narrow tolerance window because you're competing with a lot of popular stuff
mm-hmm.
that's survived a long selection test. And to be instantly above that top 5, you need to really get your name up there.
Right.
That's something not a whole lot of manga artists can do. I'm not sure I agree with Jump's approach, though I think the manga that have been canceled recently deserve to be.
Mm-hmm.
The approach of giving manga as little time as they've been given is sort of, I think, counterproductive to producing good manga.
Yeah, I do appreciate them involving the fans, though. And again, I mean, more often than not, the system does work. You know, there are unfortunate examples like MXO, like Double Arts, but those are in the minority if you look back historically. There's a very good reason why we haven't heard of so many titles, because if you go back and read some of them, they are... by and large, considerably poorer than the series that have survived. So, yeah, flawed system, but it does have its merits. So, I guess we're going to find out more about this series within this exam. Exams tend to be enjoyable shonen arcs, wouldn't you say? Exam/tournament?
It looks like more of a tournament arc, probably,
based
on what
it's
going into.
based on the Chunin exam from Naruto, if this is anything like that, then it's going to make the series much more enjoyable, much more interesting.
Right. Okay, that takes care of the group discussions. I don't believe either of you have any individual series to discuss, so I will discuss my three this week, starting off with Gintama Chapter 312. Again, this is another brief translation/scanlation note. You may not have read this one. I had to download the raws and read it alongside with a translation, so you may not have read this one yet. It is fantastically funny. It's completely just a one-off gag comedy chapter entirely involving the music of Kimura Kaeda. Basically, the premise of which is that the three main characters, Gintoki, Shinpachi, and Kagura, wake up in a dream together, and they're just in this like dark black nothingness, and a voice is speaking to them, telling them that they need to learn a special move. It breaks the fourth wall the entire way through, because the Gintama anime has ended, and this guy is panicking because Gintama the manga is going to lose sales, and so Gintoki needs to learn a special move to be able to boost sales of the manga and get a new anime, and he wants him to get a video game first, just to get his name back out there. And so to try to train him to learn this new move, he shows how he's been training other people to learn their own special moves. And it's all the stupid characters from throughout the series, like Katsuda and Hasegawa. And they're all training, but they're not just training. They're training by singing Ring-a-Ding-Dong, the new single by Kimura Kaela. Which is, it's called Ring-a-Ding-Dong, and the lyrics are like Ring-a-Ding-Dong, Ring-a-Ding-Ding-Dong. It's very, very brilliantly funny chapter of just all these different side characters singing Ring-a-Ding-Dong. And yeah. Go check that chapter out if you can find it. Katekyo Hitman Reborn 295, which is, again, heading up to the actual inheritance ceremony. You get to see a bunch of old characters we've kind of forgotten about, very specifically Naito Longchamp, we haven't seen for almost since the beginning of the series at that point. That was a pretty big surprise to see him. But you also got to see Dino and a couple other older, more familiar faces. And then by and large, it is a setup chapter for the actual inheritance ceremony. It's basically a chapter used to illustrate the fact that everyone is present for whatever climax is going to happen to happen. And then finally, catching up on Nurarihyon no Mago, chapters 108 through 110. I mentioned earlier during the Great Shonen tier list that Nura is going to be re-tiered shortly because he's finally learning to master his fear. He's finally realized that he cannot just gain this power on his own. He can't overcome these obstacles on his own. The entire purpose of a hyakiyako is to use other people's fear that are in your hyakiyako, use their fear, have them cast their fear into you, and then you project your own fear onto your enemy. And so now Nura is looking exceptionally strong. He's finally gone back and he's fighting with Tsuchigumo to save Tsurata, and it's looking as though this is going to be a fairly big display of his newfound strength. So very excited to see that. And again, once we do have a more clear understanding of his power, he will be re-tiered. But that does take care of the This Week in Manga segment. We're going to do Chapters of the Week now. Clint, you're up first.
All right, my Chapter of the Week, as a surprise to no one, will be Bakuman 91. I talked about most of this in the chapter discussion, but it was just an excellent chapter overall. Every page of it was well done. From the parts about Fukuda with his bike racer series to the moving scene at the graveyard. It was an excellent chapter.
True.
My chapter of the week is going to be Toriko 98. I just like seeing Komatsu advance as a character and especially grow a bit more manly, grow a bit more of a suitable partner for Toriko and gain worldwide respect. And it just really gets me optimistic as to where the manga is going to go from here with the next ingredient that they're going to have to hunt down.
And my chapter of the week, like Clint, is Bakuman 91. I was just absolutely blown away by this chapter from start to finish. Everything involving Fukuda and Road Racer, his new series, was already excellent. I really loved seeing the interplay, looking up at the rankings that they were getting from the early returns of the survey results. But the scene on page 17 near the end of the chapter with Mashiro at the graveyard just absolutely floored me. Took a turn that I never expected it to go, and really legitimately, genuinely impressed me. So yeah, definitely backing Clint's selection on that one, Bakuman 91. And that wraps up the show for this week, so thank you very much for listening. Really appreciate you tuning in. We'll be back next week with Current and Classic. Current will be History's Strongest Disciple, Kenichi. Classic will be Hikaru no Go. Let's do Final Flash.
Kenichi, put more clothes on Shigure.
Sakura Wars restored my faith in modern RPGs.
The new season of the best show on television premiered over the weekend, Top Gear Season 15. Power! See you next week.